From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's the season of casseroles and pies and heavy meat dishes. It's the season of loosening dietary restrictions and enjoying the abundance of food. According to a 2016 study published in the New England Journal of Medicine and as reported by MSN, the average American's weight increases by almost 0.5% over Christmas, just 0.2% over Thanksgiving. But it's only problematic, according to researchers, because most people don't lose that weight, and so each year the scale ticks up. But chefs around the country are talking about the holidays this year in a slightly different way. The 2019 holiday food trends have less to do with unrestrained indulgence and have more of a focus on delicious, high quality, yes, even healthy food, food that's as satisfying as that sweet potato casserole layered with all the unnecessary sugar and marshmallow bologna. With me to explore some of these trends that he's been all about his entire career is Chef Dean Neff, formerly of Pinpoint Restaurant and a recently nominated James Beard Award semifinalist. Dean Neff is also getting ready to open a new restaurant in downtown Wilmington called One South Front, which is at the corner of Market and Front Streets, and he'll tell us about it. Dean Neff, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. And of course, during the live Thursday discussion, we're inviting you to join the conversation. What kind of recipe are you looking for this holiday season? Are you approaching your holiday table in a new way? Tell us about it by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. Dean Neff, tell us about the new restaurant first. When does it open and what is the theme?
Well, we're hoping the restaurant will be open in June. There are a lot of opening a restaurant is insane. And, I'm very hopeful that we can get everything together, but we've got a really great team working on it. And so we're hoping it'll be June. The theme is going to be American seafood, and specifically Wilmington seafood, really. American restaurant focusing on seafood. We're going to serve breakfast, kind of a grab and go with great coffee. We're also going to have a small lunch menu, and then we're going to pull out all the stops for seafood at night. I feel like there's so many great sources of seafood in this town. And like with produce, we see kind of seasonality really playing into the seafood market here. And so we want to shine a light on that and really kind of put that front and center.
And you've been very involved with local seafood in terms of you participated in something with one of our local nonprofits over the spring, summer, in terms of teaching people how to cook seafood in a healthy way and how to find healthier seafood that's not so heavy metal heavy.
Yep, that's right. And, you know, a lot of that was the Fish Smart initiative. Chef Keith Rhodes was involved. A bunch of great people were involved with that. But it's all about kind of empowering people to, you know, use seafood that is, you know, it's going to be healthier and typically is not being sourced from the Cape Fear River. There are, you know, varieties that are okay, but, you know, we try to always steer people, knowledge is power, and we want people to make good choices with their seafood.
And as we talk about what's going to be on the holiday table, I do want to kind of explore your overarching philosophy about this, because we've been doing a series, A Place at the Table with you this year. It's been quarterly, roughly, and this is the big holiday show where we explore all the fantasy foods. But your philosophy doesn't really change, your food philosophy, and it's always been this way. Explain what it is.
Yeah, so, you know, cooking good food to me is all about ingredients, and cooking can be very complex. There's a lot of moving parts, so I think the way to have the best results oftentimes is to kind of take a single ingredient and really think about the best approach. And then, you know, adding in other ingredients that are sort of outside of the, actual cooking process can be sort of to enhance that ingredient. But, you know, we take Brussels sprouts, for example, a food that I grew up experiencing boiled with vinegar. And it was
Saying that with distaste?
No,
is that what I'm picking up on?
There may be a version of boiled Brussels sprouts that I have not tried yet that I would change my mind. But it was a real eye-opening experience the first time I tried really great Brussels sprouts that had been blanched and then browned in butter. It just, you know, a kid would eat Brussels sprouts that are browned in butter, and it's kind of about thoughtful preparation and really taking these ingredients and trying to kind of stand back and let the ingredient kind of shine on its own.
Which is the opposite of layering so many of the schmeary ingredients. And I'm thinking about, you know, sweet potato casserole as an example. That's often used as a side dish at the holiday table. And you have kind of a fresh take on that isn't so sugar heavy.
Yeah. So, well, you know, I think...
Does that make it a little more depressing because it is the holiday season? Do we need all the sugar?
I don't think we need all the sugar. I don't think so. I mean, we can, you know, enjoy a cocktail and a glass of wine and, you know, leave the marshmallows out of it. So I think it's all about, you know, picking what kind of things you want to really indulge in. And with sweet potatoes, for me, it's all about kind of concentrating natural sugars within the sweet potato. Boiling sweet potatoes is not a great thing because it kind of will pull out flavors, pull out sugars. If you roast them slowly, you kind of really concentrate all of those natural sugars. And then if you want to enhance the sweetness at all, use a little bit of sorghum, brown butter. That's always kind of a good way to go, just so it's not overly sweet.
Now, I want to really go back to the centerpiece of the holiday meal first. So I know that you're a big fan of making turkey the... I'm dripping with sarcasm here. No, what's your take on turkey right now?
Well, I like turkey. Turkey is always a challenging thing to cook at home. And I think we've, you know, gotten through Thanksgiving and people are most likely over turkey at this point.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, there's nothing against turkey. I just feel like Christmas time should be the time when you kind of break out something new and exciting. And, you know, something that I think would be really fun, especially in this area, is a whole smoked fish. And right now, kind of the seasonal offerings that we're really seeing an abundance of in this area, speckled sea trout, one of the best fish of all time, in my opinion. And they're, you know, all over the place right now. They're actually not to be confused with mountain trout. So they're a saltwater fish. And focusing on taking a whole fish, it kind of gives you the same element of passing a plate around the table and sharing. I feel like the whole, you know, the big presentation is a good way to go for Christmas and family dinners, Thanksgiving, because you're kind of sharing and passing plates, and it's just a more interactive experience. But try doing it with fish.
How do you smoke a fish?
Well, there's a couple different ways, but typically with trout, what I like to do is I like to get whole fish, make sure scales have been removed, make sure it is super fresh. We're looking for really clear eyes, bright red gills, not a fishy smell. Fresh fish smells like the ocean and does not smell fishy, just to make that point. And what I typically do is I make a really simple brine with lots of lemon, salt, sugar, water, fresh herbs, and brine the whole fish after it's had all of the innards removed, brine it for about an hour or two, take it and then roast it really slowly, and then we smoke it. You can smoke it by doing a simple smoke box in the oven, which is a really easy concept we can talk about in a little bit.
You're listening to Coastline. So a smoke box, what is it? How does it work?
So smoke box is you're creating a little area of smoke in an oven that is turned off. So when you're smoking, typically there's hot smoking, which is cooking whatever the meat or vegetable, and cold smoking, which is you're just imparting smoke flavor. Smoke box is putting wood chips. I like apple chips or pecan wood would be great with fish. You're lighting it on fire and then extinguishing the flames and putting it into your oven and shutting the door with the ingredient in the oven. And so it allows it to, the smoke will kind of, you know, swirl around and touch the fish and impart that really wonderful smokiness. To me, this time of year, smoke is kind of the ultimate comfort smell in the air. When you walk out and you smell a fire, it just makes you feel, you know, comforted. And, you know, imparting that flavor in food is just kind of a really nice touch for certain ingredients. And I think whole fish is a great one. You can do it with vegetables, obviously beef, pork, duck. There's really, you can smoke anything.
And so you're imparting the flavor of the smoke, but then how do you actually cook the piece of meat?
So when we're talking about fish, what I like to do is season it really well, sprinkle fresh herbs and maybe lemon, and then roast it at about 140 to 200 degrees, really light, low heat to start. And then we're going to smoke it, and then you want to kind of turn up an oven at the very end after smoking it for about 3 to 4 minutes. For fish, heavier meats, you could smoke much longer. But then what you do is you'll take it out and you'll put it in a hotter oven and really try to crisp the skin with a higher heat.
And what other kinds of meats would be good, would be conducive to this kind of a technique?
Yeah, so, you know, cooking vegetables and kind of making a vegetable the centerpiece, I think, is a really strong move. And you can kind of put all of the love and thought into preparing a vegetable that you would put into cooking, you know, meat. And you get really good results.
Okay, and I'm going to ask you more about that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. It's our annual holiday food show with Chef Dean Neff. When we come back from this break, we'll have some new ideas as well for holiday desserts. If you'd like to share a recipe, or if you have some questions with a holiday dish that you've always struggled with, send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's the Holiday Food Show with Chef Dean Neff. And not only are we getting some new ideas for holiday dishes, we're finding out how to up-level some of the old standards so they're fresher, exciting, and maybe even a little better for you. If you have a recipe to share, a family tradition that you think is really fun, or if you're having trouble with a dish, send us an email during the live Thursday discussion at coastline@whqr.org. And Dean, just before we went to break, you were starting to explain how to think about, for some people who want to make vegetables the centerpiece of their meal and not have a giant animal on the table.
Yeah, or to kind of also bring in a preparation of a vegetable in addition to the meat. I think it can make your vegetarian family and friends feel welcome and show them that you put a little love into kind of a centerpiece dish that was for them. Cauliflower and kabocha squash. Kabocha squash, they're in the, you know, winter squash, pumpkin family. Really beautiful squash. You see them at the markets occasionally. Right now, they definitely have some at Whole Foods. But they're so sweet and beautiful. They have a really bright orange color that's very different than, and they're a lot sweeter, I think, than butternut squash typically. But yeah, taking those, thinking about spice and rubs, I think is great with these, you know, whether it's cauliflower or kabocha squash. Also, a quick trip, a trick rather, if you feel like you're not wanting to smoke, actually smoke things in your house, harissa is kind of a good answer to that. This is a spice and chili rub where you can impart lots of smoky paprika and chilies that will give you the smoke without leaving a cloud of smoke in your house. So that could be a good way to do it. But cauliflower and kabocha squash both kind of require a combination cooking technique, which is, you know, either lightly steaming first and then roasting, or vice versa. You want to that will make the vegetable nice and tender, but then it's really crucial to get good color on it. So you could grill it. You could roast it in an oven. But giving it spice is a good thing.
And harissa is something that you can either buy as a condiment in the store or you can make it. You actually have a recipe for harissa.
I do. And yeah, I think we're going to hopefully have that on the website. Yes. So you can use it. But yeah, it's just a very, very simple rub and adds a whole lot of flavor. There's a little bit of star anise in there. When I say spice, I think there are certain spices that are really high volume, which most people could kind of dial back in their cooking.
Like what?
Cloves are one of those. Like cloves are something that is the only thing I taste if I can taste them. But if they're used sparingly, sometimes they work with other spices and kind of remain in the background and add some dimension. But I think another one is nutmeg. It's kind of can be very powerful, but it's also those ingredients are crucial ingredients. But I think you just have to be careful, use them sparingly, and taste as you go. But star anise to me is a really surprising, wonderful winter spice. It works with citrus. It works with cumin. Bay leaves, sage. You can really use it in brines and rubs, and it's very mild. And I think it's surprisingly, works really well with smoke and meats.
You also love short ribs, and that is a possibility for the centerpiece on the holiday table. How do you prepare those?
Absolutely, short ribs are—they're just easy, and that's one of the reasons I love them because they're delicious, they're satisfying, comforting, and they're just so easy. So it's a really simple method of it's a braise, and so braising is again the combination like we talked about with vegetables. I love that you can look at two things that are very different and see that the technique is actually kind of the same. But braising short ribs, we're going to season them up heavily with salt and pepper. You can use a little porcini powder. And then you're going to caramelize them and sear them off in a pan. And I kind of like to go lower heat to begin with and let them go longer so you really render out a lot of that fat cap that tends to be on them. And then what we do is we deglaze the pan with a little bit of red wine and then add some stock and add some aromatic vegetables, cover them, and then they go into the oven about 300 degrees for 4 to 5 hours until they're tender. You can get them bone in or bone out. Both are delicious. And they're fairly inexpensive. And it's just a really great, when they're done, they smell wonderful. The work is kind of done ahead of time. So when you pull them out of the oven, they're ready to go and you don't have to think about it.
We had some folks commenting on social media when they start to think about their own holiday tables. And Kim, thank you for this. Kim says, is it ever acceptable to cover grapes with Cool Whip and call it a salad?
Sure. I would try that. I'm not opposed to Cool Whip.
Really?
I grew up eating Cool Whip. Cool Whip and pumpkin pie was kind of something that was defines Thanksgiving Thanksgivings of my childhood.
And you were telling me before we started this that you actually grew up kind of the only food enthusiast in your family and tried to cook the perfect piece of chicken for your chicken sandwich when you were a
frying
kid.
Frying chicken. I had this dream of making the perfect chicken sandwich. Chicken, mayonnaise, tomato, lettuce was kind of my idea as a young child, and I was probably 8 years old. But yeah, I think, a lot of chefs have a rich background of, farming in their childhood and, really good food memories. And I think a lot of mine, while, my mother is a great cook, but both of my parents worked. And so I feel like a lot of my food memories were kind of built around convenience. And so I don't know if it was my way of kind of trying to take control of my food a little bit or what, but I found a lot of comfort in the kitchen experimenting, and I could not figure out as a child how to cook a piece of fried chicken until it was done all the way in the center. So I would fry it and then cut into it and it would be raw, and then I would put it back into the fryer. It was, yeah.
That's just really adorable. I just have to say that. So we're not going to go in order then in terms of dishes. Tom Erickson of the Transplanted Garden, a friend of both of ours, yep, and a friend of the station's. The Transplanted Garden is an underwriter, writes in, and you had actually mentioned this before when we were talking about this show. He says, Dean, I have an abundance of pomelo. What about a vinaigrette with them? I love cardamom and star anise. What else can I do? And would you like some again this year? So, first of all, for folks who aren't familiar with pomelo, tell us what that is.
So, pomelo are they're supposed to be kind of the original citrus fruit before, you know, oranges and grapefruit, and they are a little bit more tart. The juice is tart, but they are the most fragrant citrus fruit I've ever had, and so they're really interesting. Tom has been so gracious to share these with us for 2 years now, and you know, they are so wonderful, and a vinaigrette would be really great.
How would you prepare them?
Yeah, so they, you know, like with most citrus fruit, the pith can actually be bitter. With pomelos, it's especially big, the pith, which is the white part of the citrus fruit, and you really want to make sure and kind of keep that out of whatever you're making. So the rinds and the zest, really phenomenal, fragrant, oily, delicious. And then the juice is really tart and also interesting in its own way. And I think, you know, one of the tricks in working with ingredients is to kind of figure out if there is, you know, with pomelos, we've got a lot of tartness in these pomelos. And so you want to balance that with a little bit of sweet to make it more palatable. You don't want to go overboard for sure. But, you know, you could kind of steep some of the juice with star anise and maybe a little bit of honey. I think a little bit of vanilla would be really nice in there as well, and kind of make a vinaigrette like that. That would be a great starting point.
Some
good olive oil.
We could
do a spinach salad. You could dress spinach salad and get some. Right now, persimmons are in season, and if you go to Asian Life Market, they've got them an abundance of persimmons, different varieties that are super cheap, and you can take those and dress them with this pomelo vinaigrette, and all of a sudden you've got something really different, really unique. You know, a nice goat cheese or farm cheese would be nice with it. And Tom, thank you so much for the pomelos.
And you have used pomelo for pie, for dessert? Not pie, but...
Typically, you could make a curd if you wanted to. So you would take, you know, your classic lemon curd or lemon meringue pie and just kind of use the pomelo. But again, be careful not to zest past the actual zest and get into the pith. Otherwise, you could end up, you know, with something that's bitter. Also, candying citrus is a great way to highlight it on a dessert. You're basically slicing it thinly and very carefully simmering it in a sugar simple syrup. Again, put star anise. Star anise and citrus is so wonderful. You put a little rosemary in there, too, if you wanted. And just kind of candy it, cook it down. And then what we do is we take it, put it on a baking sheet with parchment paper, put a little, you know, thin coating of oil on the parchment paper, and then slowly, low heat, 200 degrees, roast them and dry them out in the oven. And you've got wonderful candied citrus.
You're listening to Coastline. Chef Dean Neff is with us for our holiday food show. And he's answering your questions on this Thursday. What's your favorite holiday dish? What will you absolutely put on your table? And what parts of the meal are ready for a change? You can email us during the live Thursday discussion at coastline@whqr.org. Another citrus that you've talked about as being a nice component of the holiday meal, preserved lemons.
Yes.
That sounds complicated.
It's very easy, and it's something that I would really recommend people who, you know, who love cooking, try this technique. It's so easy. So first, working with organic lemons is a good way to go, because you're going to really be focusing on using the zest of these lemons kind of on their own. But what we do is we take them and cut them into cross sections and then create a kosher salt blend. Sea salt would be nice, but it would be so expensive because we're going to need a lot of the salt to really pack these lemons in with salt. I like to add spices like cardamom, star anise, bay leaves, black pepper, mustard seeds are good as well. Ginger can be really nice in there also. Mixing those ingredients with kosher salt, you cut the lemons into a cross section, not all the way through, and pack the insides with salt, squeeze them, and then bury them in salt in a pickle jar. They go into your refrigerator, the longer the better, and make sure they're, you know, staying completely covered with salt. You'll notice that as salt is in contact with the citrus, it'll pull the juice out of the lemons, and in the bottom of the jar, you'll see a liquid will begin to form. You can use that for a rub if you wanted to. I mean, like, the flavor is so wonderful, and you can really just add such nice, bright flavor to any dish with preserved lemon. And it's something that, you know, you can't just go buy at the store. It's something that takes your creative power and a little foresight to get it ready, because it does take a little while to have them.
What's the shortest period of time? You said the longer the better that they preserve.
Probably 2 months would be the shortest amount of time. And lemons are typically the best because they have a higher acid acidity content. You know, a lot of things like pomelo may not have that acidity level. I may try pomelo, but I think that you could do it. But I think lemons are kind of the safest, easiest way to go about doing it.
Is that something that would also work with limes or any other?
It would work with limes, and it actually does. Limes, they need to go for a long period of time. And one thing I've noticed actually preserving limes is that the actual zest will almost go a little brown instead of staying bright green, whereas with the lemons, it stays, you know, nice and bright yellow.
You're listening to Coastline. Oyster South, what is that?
All right, so Oyster South is a charitable organization that celebrates, elevates, cultivates environmental, economic, and cultural value of Southern sustainable farm-raised oyster industry. And it is this year they're actually having a symposium in Wilmington at the Embassy Suites in February. And it's all about empowering oyster farmers and giving them kind of networks to learn how to, you know, troubleshoot and start their businesses and become successful oyster farmers. They call it the peer-to-peer program, P-E-E-R to P-I-E-R program, which is pretty good.
Clever.
Yep. And it enables farmer members to travel to other oyster farms throughout the U.S. and kind of get firsthand farming knowledge from other oyster farmers.
Wow.
Yeah, so they're having their symposium here February 21st through the 23rd, and it's just a great organization. And you know, oysters right now, it is the time of year for oysters. Wintertime, the months with an R, is when oysters are great and people are thinking about oysters.
And so that old adage is really true.
Well,
you're talking about local oysters, yeah, in a warm climate.
It actually, some people. They're actually available and great year-round now, and that's kind of thanks to these oyster farmers as well. But I think, you know, inherent, it's kind of like someone, and I love oysters in the summer, but technically they're in season in the winter, and this is kind of the time of year. And so, you know, bring some oysters to Christmas dinner this year.
Would you?
Yes.
How would you prepare them, or would you?
You can prepare them just by opening them and a little simple what we call a mignonette, which is a lightly vinegary sauce. You can use, you know, a little bit of champagne vinegar, something that's like clean and bright. Lemon is great. Hot sauce is great. You could broil oysters. It's kind of all about what
do you broil them?
It all depends on what you're, you know, kind of what you're going for. The great thing about, there's a sauce that I feel like can really help you cook holiday meals, like the go-to sauce that everyone should learn how to make so they can stop using cream of mushroom soup is bechamel. And so
bechamel on oysters?
Yeah. And that's a good way to kind of a sauce or a vehicle to add other flavors. You can kind of, bechamel is kind of the base for oysters Bienville. So we've got mushrooms and bacon and onions and lemon and chilies in oyster Bienville. You could also take blue crab meat, mix it with a little bit of bechamel and lemon and chilies and broil them that way too. But, shucking an oyster, making sure there's no shells in there, topping it with a little bit of your bechamel that you've chosen to make, and then a little bit of breadcrumbs. Bake them in the oven or bake and then broil. It's kind of a good way to do it, and you want to make sure that you've got nice bubbly topping on there.
Lee on Facebook said prime rib on Christmas Day.
Yes.
That's the thing.
It is the thing. I agree. I'm all about prime rib. Delicious. You know, I've said this before, but I love making rubs for beef that have lots of porcini mushroom powder. It makes a really great kind of flavor enhancer that most people, even if you don't like mushrooms, you really wouldn't know it was there. Probably you just know that the meat was delicious.
Is that something you can buy as a...
Yeah, I think you can buy it at, I think your grocery store should have it. I think Tidal Creek or Whole Foods would carry probably mushroom powder. Asian markets also will sell dried shiitakes. You can pulverize those in a coffee grinder and kind of make your own as well.
Amy says, my husband makes amazing chocolate truffles.
Ooh, yum.
Yeah, that sounds good. And on the dessert note, Susan says, I have to make my dark brown sugar vanilla bean spiked with bourbon ice cream, which we add to whatever pie. Dark brown sugar vanilla bean.
Sounds expensive.
It actually does. So when we're talking about some of these elaborate holiday meals, and again, your focus has been on making the star ingredient, the actual star, and using a really solid technique along with some other complementary ingredients, but not overwhelming it. How many courses would you prepare for a good holiday meal? And I'm going to get you to answer that question when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. It's our annual holiday food show with Chef Dean Neff. Let us know if you have a holiday food question or if you'd like help with a technique, and tell us about those absolute musts that have to be on your festive table. Email us during the live Thursday discussion at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this short break, we'll have just one more segment for you to get your question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Dean Neff, formerly of Pinpoint Restaurant, soon to be the chef and owner of One South Front, set to open next June 2020 at the corner of Front and Market Streets, is with us today to take a closer look at some exciting ways to up-level those old holiday standards on your table and possibly make them a little more exciting and maybe even a little healthier in the process. You can ask your own question on this Thursday or share your holiday food tradition with us by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get that food idea or question in. So just before we went to break, I asked you about how many dishes you would have on your holiday table. What's realistic for you? What is a good menu?
I think you want to make sure that your table is rounded out so that people can, you know, if they're vegetarian, they have options. Also kind of color, you know, judging by the look of everything, making sure that, you know, if there's a green salad is always nice. Soup can be very nice as well. I would say a starchy side or two, and then a side or two of vegetables, and then one dessert. If you want to have some, you know, things for snacks when people arrive, the cheese ball can be, you know, you could do like the pimento cheese.
Would you do a cheese,
yeah,
a pimento cheese
absolutely
ball?
Absolutely, I would.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So you could do that. Cheese straws are good. Snacks, you know, toasted walnuts, things like that are, you know, easy and give people something to snack on. But keep it simple. Focus on, you know, doing, you know, making the food that you are cooking great, and don't get overwhelmed with too much stuff.
How do you make sure that people don't fill up on the things that you have scattered around the table? One of our listeners said Chex Mix.
I love Chex Mix.
Yeah, I mean, you can't go wrong there. But
Maybe just put a put a small amount of Chex Mix out, and when it runs out, hide the bag.
So one of the things that we haven't explored yet, collards are a huge part of the winter food landscape here in southeastern North Carolina. And you think they have a place on the holiday table. How would you do them?
Absolutely. Personally, I think the collards that we get locally are so good. We have so many great farmers in this area. You go out to the farmer's market, Tidal Creek on Saturday, and you'll just be amazed at all the abundance of great produce. And right now, collards to me are kind of a must for Christmas dinner. The best way to do it is to think about building flavors. Great collards always have pork products and preferably sort of a fattier cut of pork, which is bacon. So I would say good bacon, rendering that down in a pan with lots of onions, adding in your collards and kind of beginning to cook them, and then adding in, we have to make this base, which is going to become our pot liquor. And I like to add a little sherry vinegar and also a little stock. And people may get up in arms about this, but I love either a little bit of sorghum or a little bit of brown sugar and some chili flake in there. And one thing to watch out as these layers, collard greens start out with tremendous volume. And as you cook them down, they shrink down to nothing. But as they're shrinking, you want to make sure and kind of balance. You don't want to add too much liquid to begin with. You want to add the right amount so they don't burn, though, because if you and also kind of keep an eye on your heat. Cook them down slowly, check them often, season them as you go. You can always add more vinegar. Apple cider vinegar would be great, too. Lots
How long
of bacon.
Do they, have
they,
to cook?
They cook for, 45 minutes to, an hour and a half. And they cook down and they just become so delicious and so comforting. And it's really crucial that bacon to make sure that your bacon is rendered down before you add, before you add your liquid so that you've gotten rendered all of that fat. And, there's something about the bacon fat coating the greens, which is just what collards are all about.
Megan says, my grandmother's pineapple casserole. That's what she has.
That sounds good.
On the table. And Jennifer says, coconut cake.
Yum.
What desserts are going to be on your holiday table?
Lydia is very adamant about this, and ginger cake is kind of her go-to for Christmas, and her ginger cake is wonderful.
And just to be clear, Lydia is your partner.
She is.
And she owns Love Lydia, the bakery, which is on 3rd Street.
Yep.
Near Greenfield.
Yep, and she's been nice enough to give us one of her ginger cake recipe, actually, so if you're interested in trying it, it'll be on the website as well. But it's just, a little bit of spice. In this one, we've put a little bit of candied citrus, which we talked about earlier, persimmon, and then whipped cream, or there's also diplomat cream, which I love. It's kind of half whipped cream mixed with half pastry cream. And so pastry cream is the classic eclair filling. And, whipped cream somewhere in between is you end up with this really light and really tasty topping for this. And you could also do a cream cheese frosting, which would be really good on this as well.
Ooh, yeah. Why is Lydia such a fan of the ginger cake? What is it about that?
I think because, it's seasonally appropriate. The spices that are in there are wonderful, comforting. And, Lydia does not, she doesn't really conform to a lot of like traditions and she which I think is she's always kind of pushing to, do things differently and to challenge herself. And so, yeah, that's the short answer.
And that's why we love Lydia.
It is.
And the name of her bakery. So people always talk about cocktails at holiday parties out there with the Chex Mix. Gin seems to be an emerging thing. Now, this might just be the single-handed influence of our mutual friend, Vic Roberts, who is from England and recently was on to talk about English food history and origins and English cooking. But is this an emerging thing here? And are you going to be offering gin during your holiday gatherings?
Unless Vic is coming over, we probably will not be offering gin. But But gin is great. And, you know, like a classic gin fizz or, you know, an Aperol and gin drink. I mean, you can also utilize all this beautiful citrus that we're seeing. Pomelos would be amazing and so unique in a gin drink. For me personally, I'm a fan of wassail.
And tell us what's in wassail.
Yeah, so wassail is...
There are Christmas songs that go along with that.
There are.
Which I won't break into right now, but I'm tempted.
So yeah, wassail is a drink that my mom made every year as we were decorating the Christmas tree. And it is based... apple cider is the base, and then you add in spice, cinnamon, star anise, citrus, a little bit of cranberry juice, and it cooks down all day. And
as it's an alcoholic beverage,
well,
right?
It can be, and you know, when I was young, I didn't experience the alcohol.
That's why you had such a happy childhood.
Exactly. and you can add rum to it. You can add, you could add bourbon to it as well. And it's just this, you know, when it's cold out, it's exactly what you want.
Do you know what the origins are of wassail? Like which?
No, I don't.
Not a fair question. What other kinds of beverages would you serve at your holiday table?
Yeah, I think, you know, with the you know, same with drinks and with food. When you're drinking, you should think about it seasonally. White wine, obviously, is a summertime kind of thing. I love, you know, red wine, mulled wines, bourbon drinks, you know, with apple and spice, I think are wonderful. And thinking about dark rums and things like that can be kind of good foundations for kind of wintry drinks. But you always want to think about season when thinking about, you know, all aspects of what you're serving. And cocktails are definitely part of that.
Yes. And thank you, Vic. She just wrote in and said, "You mean Dean isn't considering Spotted Dick for Christmas?" Sorry, Vic, that was a horrible...
It was great, actually. You channeled Vic.
Spotted Dick, what is that?
So that, you know what's funny is Spotted Dick is a dessert that we served at our Seasoned Gourmet class, and Vic shared this recipe with me. It is a custard, and... you know, we basically served it with a creme anglaise. One thing that it really reminded me of after making it, I had never made Spotted Dick before until this cooking class, and I was very, very scared, you know, in pulling off this recipe because it was, I believe the ingredients were raisins, flour, butter, and that was it. And I was like, there's no way this can taste good. It actually was good when it was all put together, but sticky date pudding is one of... It's one of my favorite desserts. It's also a really fantastic dessert for this time of year. It is sweetened naturally by medjool dates. There's a little bit of orange zest. It's lightly cakey. You can serve it with ice cream or creme anglaise. So I'll probably stick with that version of Spotted Dick this year.
You're listening to Coastline. And we had another listener ask about what's for pudding. So you just described one particular version, but what are some other puddings that might be intriguing and fun to try that we don't often put on our holiday tables here in the United States?
That's a good question. And I guess, you know, there's so many, as we know, especially through Vic kind of guiding us through her versions of biscuits and puddings and all these different foods, that there are a lot of different kind of versions of things, and some are very different than, you know, the one that we're familiar with. One thing that I really enjoy is pot de creme. So it's a kind of a custard. You could call it a pudding if you want. Very different than what we were just talking about with sticky date pudding and things like that. But that is it's an egg thickened custard, much like a creme brulee, and they're so delicious. They're satisfying. People just go nuts over them. And there's something that can be made a day or two in advance, and you can pop them in the fridge and you serve them with a dollop of whipped cream, some candied black walnuts and persimmon, and they're done. And so they're very convenient. They're very satisfying. Chocolate pot de creme is one of my favorites when it's done really well. And so I would recommend that kind of pudding for your Christmas dinner.
When you think about making the dinner, it's a little different for you and Lydia because you guys are professionals, and so you probably have a lot of the prep work. You have harissa, your condiment maid, and you've preserved your lemons. But for those of us who aren't operating at that level, what would you recommend in terms of a time frame for planning and shopping and then putting things together?
It kind of depends on the person and your speed of prep. If you have a large working surface and a sharp knife, your prep is going to get done a lot faster than if you have a dull knife and you're working on a very small counter. But I think that shopping, you can get your shopping done in 45 minutes, I would imagine, to an hour. And then prep time, depending on what you're making, I would think about creating dishes that kind of, like we were talking about with pot de creme, we've made that a day or two in advance. Short ribs, we start in the morning, they go into the oven, and there's this, 4 to 5 hour window until they're done. They can be cooled and then reheated, actually. If you wanted to do them the day before, that would be fine. So thinking about those things, they'll empower you as far as your timing and making sure that, everything's not happening at once, so you can kind of plan it. I would write a schedule and prep lists. In the restaurant, we're all about prep lists always. They keep you on track and they really help you organize your time. So that's kind of a secret that I think a lot of times people maybe don't do as often at home. I actually should do that more when I'm cooking at home as well.
You probably don't need to that as much. One of the things we haven't talked about, chestnuts. I think of chestnuts as a really fun, either Dickensian thing that sputter and crackle noisily on the fire, but don't taste very good. Or I think of them as things that are roasted in rat and roach infested food carts in major cities around the country. But you think that they can be a really nice ingredient for local holiday tables.
Yeah.
In what way?
Well, chestnuts, I also grew up cooking chestnuts over the fire, and I liked burning them and cooking them, but I hated eating them because they tend to be mealy. They're just an interesting ingredient, and you really have to kind of compensate for the fact that they are mealy. Some people may like the texture. To me, the texture is a little bit off-putting, but I love the flavor of them, and of course I love anything that you toast over an open fire is fun. So turning them into a soup I think is a great use of chestnuts. So kind of creating a really simple soup, either with vegetable stock or chicken stock, depending on if you're keeping it vegetarian or not. Celery root, celery, fennel, leeks, bay leaf, a little bit of thyme, and you cook this down, you roast your chestnuts, add them in, and then puree them smooth into the soup, and then kind of strain it through a tammy just to get out any kind of vegetable fibers. And you end up with this really smooth, really flavorful chestnut soup. Something else that you can do, I've noticed another problem with chestnuts is I've seen people roast them, peel them, and then try to kind of toast them in the oven. They can dry out and get hard as rocks if you do that. So being really careful not to kind of cook them too long or throw them in the oven and let them turn into rocks like that. There's a tool called a microplane, which is like a really fine shaver. Sometimes we'll use those in the restaurant to shave, roast chestnuts and then shave them. It takes care of the mealiness and just adds a lot of great flavor. So that's kind of another little trick. But chestnuts are seasonal and people associate them with, this time of year. So it's wonderful if you can figure out a good way to incorporate them into a dish. Using that microplane technique, sometimes I'll grate it over stuffing.
Oof,
like a sourdough stuffing.
Sounds so good. That is this edition of Coastline. Dean Neff, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coastline's producer is Caitlin Freund. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Rachel Keith is supervising producer. Marissa Castrino is our board operator. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.